couple that is offered to triple contributions up to $60,000 on that date. Well, you can actually triple your gift right now by going to will.illinois.edu/junejumpstart.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. So if I say I want to talk about reparations for African Americans, you say what? It's about time, that's ridiculous, who cares, it's never going to happen, or maybe even what's that? Outside of academic circles and the occasional gathering of Black nationalists, it would seem that very few people talk about reparations for African Americans these days, but that is about to change. In a 15,000-word essay for The Atlantic, Ta-Nehisi Coates, national correspondent for the magazine, describes generations of government-directed or sanctioned efforts to deprive Black people of the ability to generate wealth. And as well, he describes Black people's efforts to overcome that. He describes this as a moral debt to African Americans and says, until it is paid, this country cannot be whole. He joins us today from our bureau in New York to talk about this piece, which is already getting a lot of attention. It's called The Case for Reparations. And Ta-Nehisi Coates is with us now. Welcome. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Michelle.
So you know that in 2010, you wrote a piece. You were actually responding to a piece by the prominent scholar Henry Louis Gates Jr. about reparations. You said you don't support reparations. You said you support all people grappling with all aspects of American history. So does this piece mean you've changed your mind? And if so, what changed it?
Well, I still support all people grappling with all aspects of American history. But yes, it did. I did change my mind. And I largely changed my mind because I found myself repeatedly in conversations about the African-American problem, if we're going to call it that, over and over again. And the answers that I was getting, and even some of the answers that I was giving, just seemed insufficient. And I read, during that time, I was doing quite a bit of research, read a number of books that were deeply influential on me. Isabel Wilkerson's The Warmth of Other Suns, probably being the mother of this piece here. And my opinions changed.
Did you have a light bulb moment where it kind of all came together for you?
Isabel Wilkerson's book, The Warmth of Other Suns, describes the Great Migration. And traditionally, when we think about African Americans coming up to the South, coming up to the North, it really is a story of poverty. Her main characters and many of the people she's talking about in the book are people who, quote unquote, played by the rules. These are people who were married. These are people who had pursued some level of education very often. These are people who went to church, did everything right. Pulled their pants up, did all the things that America would ask African Americans to do, and in many cases, still nevertheless, found themselves to be plundered by American policy. That really, I think, altered a lot for me because it said even if we, go to the best case scenario for African Americans, you find racism nonetheless.
Well, the piece threaded through the story, it's framed by the story of a real person, a man named Clyde Ross. You talk about how back in Mississippi, his family had a successful farm. The white authorities there decided to cheat them out of it. And you describe how they did it through a tax debt that his dad went to court to try to deal with it. He had no lawyer. He could not read. They just decided that they were going to take all of their property, even taking Clyde's horse.
Yes.
As a little boy, because mm-hmm. some white men decided that they wanted it. And he grows up. He serves his country in the armed forces. He migrates to Chicago thinking he's getting away from this kind of mean-spirited, petty, and thoroughgoing racism that he grew up with, only to be subjected to various housing discrimination schemes. And then you describe in detail how those worked. So how did you find Clyde Ross? Did you choose him because he so perfectly encapsulated your thesis? Or is he the reason that this is what came together for you?
It was shockingly easy to find Clyde Ross. I mean, that's the most interesting thing about this aspect. The other book that really helped me with this was Burl Satter's book, Family Properties, which is specifically about the scheme contract lending that Clyde Ross got caught up in. And when I finished that book, the interesting thing to me was she was talking about a policy that had clearly affected African-American wealth, but was relatively recent. And it was quite clear to me that some of the people in that book or some of the people who had been involved in the issue must be still alive. And so I, talked to Burl, called some of the people out in Chicago who had organized around contract lending. And lo and behold, they were very much still alive, Clyde being one of them. And I went out to Chicago, interviewed them. And again, much like the people in Isabel Wilkerson's book, these were people who had basically done everything right. And yet here they were in North Lawndale, one of the poorest sections of Chicago, one of the most crime-ridden sections of Chicago. And I was very curious about what had happened to that neighborhood.
Central to your argument, though, is the idea that this is not just a few isolated mean people being mean, right?
Right.
But that the government was an active player in this. Could you just give us one example of why you say that?
Well, the most obvious is our housing policy. We, you know, in America, we like to think ourselves as a nation of rugged individuals. In fact, our entire vision of what the middle class is today, this vision of having, you know, the house, the picket fence out in the suburbs, the, you know, mom, dad, two kids, it's a heavily subsidized version. That it's social engineering. The FHA and the HOLC made a decision during the 1930s and into the 1940s, 50s, and 60s to basically subsidize the housing market. And they did this by saying to banks, if you give a loan to Americans and they default on this loan, we'll cover it. This was the FHA loan. One group of people in specific were cut out from the FHA loans, and that was African Americans. And it went even beyond that. It went to when we have the GI Bill, when we have veterans coming back who have the, you know, the chance to take advantage of education policies, housing policies. African Americans are then cut out. The discrimination begins in the government, but it basically spreads out to the entire real estate industry to the point that the government actually generated maps based on where different populations of people lived and basically marked who could be eligible for loans and who could not be eligible for loans. And this had a tremendous impact on African Americans because they would basically cut out one of the largest wealth building projects, if not the largest wealth building project in American history.
And when you say cut out, you mean what? That FHA loans could not be written under the law in areas where black people lived.
That's exactly. I mean, and the process is specifically called redlining. And basically, they had whole neighborhoods. These neighborhoods were ineligible for subsidized loans. And those neighborhoods tended to be either majority black neighborhoods or neighborhoods that the FHA termed as in transition. And it might be sufficient for one black family to move onto the block to declare a neighborhood in transition. And this has, you know, terrible, terrible implications, not just for black people, by the way, because if you're white and you're living on that block and say you're not racist at all, you know, you don't think it'd be too bad if black people moved into your neighborhood. The fact of the matter is when black people do start to move there, because the FHA has this policy of not giving loans, your property value is immediately going to go down.
So you would be rational to discriminate.
It makes
racism rational.
Yes, it does. It becomes self-justifying. The act, you know, the policy is in fact racist, and the individual then goes and, you know, makes what seems like a, you know, an irrational, you know, we have these terms like white flight, an irrational decision. But in fact, it's quite rational.
And what do you say to those? And if you're just joining us, we're speaking with Ta-Nehisi Coates, national correspondent and blogger for The Atlantic. We're talking about his 15,000-word essay where he talks about the case for reparations. Now, what do you say to people who say, okay, well, that's a bummer, but that was a long time ago. In fact, those practices were specifically outlawed with the Fair Housing, you know, Act back in 1965, and that a lot of these other government-sanctioned, government-enforced practices of discrimination went out in the 60s. And so why is this something to be talking about now?
Well, I say two things. The first is that when you injure a person, the fact that you know, stop the action that's injuring them does not mean the person has been repaired at all. You know, if somebody is stabbing you, it's very good if they stop stabbing you. It'd be much better if you were bandaged, taken to a hospital, and gotten a chance to heal. We, you know, ostensibly outlaw these practices, and I should be very clear, we have reports of redlining extending even into today, but let's just, you know, be that as it may. Let's say it did stop when we had the Fair Housing Act. We did nothing in terms of repairing the actual damage that actually was done. Beyond that, I think there's a broader argument about history. It's only when our history isn't flattering at all that we say it doesn't matter. And my argument is, if you're going to take the credit from history, you also have to take the debts that come with it. It can't be, you know, I want history when it makes me feel good, but when it, you know, when it's a bummer, I don't want any part of it.
America is a country that churns, right? Mm-hmm, the population mm-hmm. turns over. I mean, one right. out of 10 people living in this country was born somewhere else.
Right.
In fact, this kind of issue surfaced recently with there was an issue in Princeton where a young man wrote this piece that's been widely celebrated among conservatives, where this whole question on college campuses of check your privilege, you know, asking people to kind of actually identify the ways in which they are privileged in a way that they might not be used to doing. And he wrote this furious piece about, well, you know, my family's from this, you know, I'm not from here, and, you know, I don't have to check my privilege, and we came from the shtetl, and how dare you? But that is a very widely held sentiment. So what about that? I mean, the fact that this country has a very, this country's population is diverse, not just because ethnically, but also because of people are still coming here who were not part of those hierarchies of privilege that you talked about here. They couldn't have been players in the decision making.
Right, right. But by the very, you know, definition of what it means to have government and what it means to be American, they become a part of that. And, you know, we can see this in other frameworks. The most obvious of it is that to this very day, we are still paying pensions to the families of veterans of World War I. We still pay those pensions out. No one would say, well, I just got here in 1960. My family just got here in 1960. I shouldn't have to pay for that. We understand that as a collective state, we have debts that extend way beyond the individual's lifetime. And we also understand that when you become a part of America, you become a part of a bigger thing. And that thing is not just limited to the moment when you got here. The problem with reparations, you know, isn't an ancestry question. It isn't a question of when folks arrived. The problem is that it challenges something that's very, very core and deep, you know, about America. And that is us as the uncomplicated, the unvarnished, the unnuanced champion of liberty the world over. And what the question of reparations ultimately raises is that, you know, this land of liberty, this land of freedom was made possible by slavery, was made possible by plunder, was made possible by selling people's kids. That's what it is. And that's very, very hard for us to absorb and take.
What should happen in your view?
In terms of what should actually happen now is Congressman John Conyers from Michigan introduces a bill every year into the House, H.R. 40, which sets, you know, as its goal for us to study the era of enslavement and to study what the legacy of that was, the effects on African Americans, and what remedies there might be. You know, how do you begin to outline, you know, in detail what the plan is and what it looks like when we don't, you know, fully understand the problem yet? And I really want to bang that home. We don't know. You say reparations and people get so scared off and, you know, they get so, you know, upset and they get so inflamed that you can't even get to, you know, the possibility of saying, OK, so what would this seriously look like? I think the first thing that people have to, you know, come to is the idea that, yes, there is something owed. Now, can we pay it back? And that's the second question. But if you can convince people, yes, there's something owed. Now let's have a conversation about what we can do to remedy that.
Ta-Nehisi Coates writes for The Atlantic. His latest piece is titled The Case for Reparations. The issue is on the stands now. And he was kind enough to join us in our bureau in New York. Ta-Nehisi, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Coming up, many officials are trying to make their cities more workable, affordable, and livable. But what about playable?
We've actually designed kids out of cities, and this is an attempt to try to design family-friendly, child-friendly cities once again.
We're talking with the person at the center of the movement for playful cities. That's ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
The Illinois Radio Reader provides completely free access to a 24-hour stream of read aloud local, regional, and other publications, including newspapers, to our relatives, friends, and neighbors who are visually or print impaired. If you know someone who would benefit from this service, please contact Kathy Spiegel at 217-333-6503 or visit will.illinois.edu/Illinois Radio Reader. The Illinois Radio Reader is a service of Illinois Public Media.
Our broadcast day is made possible in part by the Friends of WILL and by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, inviting you to visit Promenade, the artfully affordable and exceptionally eclectic shop. More information on upcoming events is on KrannertCenter.com.
This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. It was a holiday weekend for millions of Americans, but on the other side of the world, Pope Francis was on a mission. He visited the Middle East to add his voice and presence to efforts to achieve peace and reconciliation. We wanted to know more about this visit, so we called a person whose voice will be familiar to you, Sylvia Poggioli, NPR Senior European Correspondent. Sylvia, welcome back. Thanks so much for joining us once again.
Well, thank you for having me.
Now, this isn't the first time that a pope has visited the Holy Land, of course, but there were a number of dimensions to this trip that many people saw as historic, right?
Absolutely. I think, first of all, the fact is that his entourage, I think it's the first time that we've had a pope who brought with him two good friends from his native Argentina, a rabbi, Rabbi Abraham Skorka, with whom Pope Francis has written a book, and a Muslim leader, Omar Aboud, with whom he has been dealing a great deal on interreligious affairs. So I think this already immediately set a stage for something completely new. He's coming, in a way, with a clean slate.
And it's also the first time that a pope has landed in the West Bank, right, rather than Tel Aviv. He also visited a Palestinian refugee camp, and he traveled from Amman directly to the West Bank city of Bethlehem. What was the purpose of these particular gestures?
Well, there were certainly several important nods to the Palestinians. As you said, he was the first who flew directly from Amman to the West Bank, to Bethlehem, rather than going through Israel. And the Vatican officially referred to the visit as to the state of Palestine, which also Francis repeated that phrase. Now, the Vatican has long been in favor of a two-state solution, but this was an extra boost in support of the Palestinian bid for full statehood. And he also did something else. He did an unscripted stop at the Israeli barrier wall, which Palestinians see as a symbol of Israeli oppression. He stopped there. He rested his forehead against the concrete wall and prayed. And that was certainly very moving for the Palestinians.
And he also met with refugees from the Syrian war.
Absolutely. That was in Jordan. That was an important visit because many also of these refugees are Christians and they are people fleeing the civil war. This was a double event because it was important for Pope Francis to make an appeal for religious freedom in the region, that because, you know, the number of Christians are really dwindling. In the last 20 years, they've gone something like from 20% of the population of the Middle East to maybe 4%. So that was important. He also made an appeal. He thanked Jordan very much for helping refugees. And he made an appeal to the world to not abandon Jordan, which is handling something like an official number of 600,000 Syrian refugees, which would be 10% of the Jordanian population, but some people say they may be many more, 1.3 million. So the refugees were one of the key aspects of his first day on this trip of the Middle East.
He has issued an invitation to involve himself in the Middle East peace talks. Could you tell us a little bit more about that?
He invited the Israeli and Palestinian presidents, Shimon Peres and Mahmoud Abbas, to join him in prayer at the Vatican for an end to their conflict, to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. It seems it will take place next week. On the plane, he was asked about this. He said, it's not a mediation effort, just a joint prayer. And he said it would have been best for it to happen in the region, but it would have been impossible to find the right place. So he said, I decided to invite them to my home in the Vatican. Now, it seems very unlikely that President Peres, the Israeli president, will receive a mandate from Prime Minister Netanyahu to negotiate with Abbas on renewing direct talks, which collapsed just about a month ago. So it's going to be more, you know, a very symbolic event, a great photo op, of course, but it's also at the end of Shimon Peres's mandate. So it's not likely that it's going to lead to a resumption of talks.
How so? And if you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Sylvia Poggioli. She's NPR's senior European correspondent. She really needs no introduction, but that's who she is if you just tuned in. What is the symbolic importance of this?
Well, I think to go back to the fact that this is the first non-European pope, I think he brings a very interesting and new element in his encounter with Jews and Muslims. Contrary to John Paul II, Polish-born, he carried the weight, the legacy of his country's, even he was certainly not an anti-Semite, but Poland had a very heavy legacy. It would be impossible for Jews to meet Pope John Paul II and not speak about that problem. Same goes with Pope Benedict, Joseph Ratzinger, the German. He also carried the weight of his country's past. This does not happen with Francis. He comes from Argentina. He really appears with a clean slate. Nobody can blame him for the Holocaust or on the Muslim side for the Crusades. In fact, last year, in his very first foray into international diplomacy, in a sense, it was Pope Francis who, you know, intervened when it looked like the Western powers wanted to intervene in Syria. He called a day of prayer and meditation on Syria. The fact that here, a Catholic leader intervened against the Western powers bombing a Muslim state, you know, gained him a lot of credibility in the Islamic world.
It's interesting that just in reading kind of the American media it had an element of surprise. I mean, obviously, a visit like this is a visit of a head of state. It's planned. People know where he's going to go and what he's going to do. But there was still an element of surprise, I think, that he spoke so strongly and so directly about some of these issues. I mean, what do you think the upshot is going to be?
Well, I think we have to now remember that there's a certain narrative around Pope Francis, which is, you know, he's very popular. He's very, very well liked. Even when you have some doubts about some things that maybe he hasn't changed doctrine as much as some liberal Catholics would like, you know, he comes with a tremendous amount of popularity. So I think there's a lot of benevolence. And you're right. It was a very short trip. No huge surprises other than this stopping at the wall. And he also went off script at one point when he met the refugees, denouncing arms dealers, calling the arms trade the root of evil and hatred and love of money. And he said, let's pray for these criminals who are selling weapons, fueling hatred, that they will convert. So nothing terribly surprising, but he just instills a lot of sympathy.
Finally, you know, on the way back, he spoke out against another a significant issue in the life of the church. He talked about the sexual abuse of children, and he announced that he will be meeting with some of the victims or past victims of sexual abuse by clergy. Could you talk a little bit about that?
He said he was going to meet sometime next month in June with a group of victims, sex abuse victims, several of them were Europeans, and he would meet them in where he stays in the Vatican, in his residence, and he would hold a mass with them. He also said that three bishops are currently under investigation. He did not say which ones, but he said there would be absolutely zero tolerance. He forcefully denounced clerical sex abuse of minors, and he compared it to a satanic black mass. Pretty powerful language.
How is that move being perceived? I take it there have been calls for him to meet with victims before now. Is this being seen as a bold step or a timid one?
Well, I think several of the victims groups, the most the best organized, are certainly in the United States. They have said this is just another gesture. We still have to see, you know, something much more concrete. Pope Francis appointed recently a commission to tackle the issue of clerical sex abuse in the church. The head of it is Cardinal Sean O'Malley of Boston. And four of the eight members are women. One of them is herself a survivor of sex abuse. But until something really happens, until people really see that there is a definitive policy of handing over to law enforcement any cases of suspected abuse, I think a lot of people are still holding their breath.
That was NPR senior European correspondent Sylvia Poggioli. We reached her in Rome. Sylvia, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Michelle.
So summer is almost here. For kids, they're certainly thinking about having more time to play. But have you ever thought about where kids play? More and more people are raising families in urban environments. And for kids growing up in cities, it's not always easy to find a safe place to play. So the nonprofit organization Kaboom got serious about the issue and recently partnered with the Humana Foundation to develop a national movement for playability in cities. It's called Playful City USA, and it honors communities across the country that work to give kids easy access to safe places to play. Here to tell us more is Daryl Hammond. He is the CEO and founder of Kaboom, and he joins us now in our studios in Washington, D.C. Welcome. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, first of all, just tell us what Kaboom does for people who aren't familiar with it.
So we've been around for 19 years, and we've developed over 2,600 playgrounds using corporate and community volunteers to work side by side to fight for something. And we know we've made a difference and we know we've had an impact, but we get tens of thousands of applications every year for the 200 playgrounds that we end up building.
So why are playgrounds important? I mean, let's just go back to the basic question. Why are playgrounds important? And then hopefully you'll tell us about playability and why is that important?
Yeah. Well, play is the work of kids, as Fred Rogers said. And it's a way for them both to exercise their wiggles, exercise their mind, and exercise their body. It's the way they rationalize the world around them. It's the way that they learn social connections. It's both very intricate and very simple. And it's the foundation for lifelong ability to have relationships, to have health, and to have a life prepared for living.
We talk about A lot of times when you have these surveys of, or, you know, sometimes magazines or websites will have surveys of like the livability or affordability or walkability. And you want to get people to start thinking about playability. What makes a city playable?
Yeah, for us, playable means it's the effort in which a city goes through to give all kids the balance and active play every day as the easy choice. And just like walkability, bikeability, those are generally adult things, and they're in the adult context. And we know cities are struggling to try to figure out how to be child friendly and family friendly, not just to attract the creative class, but to be able to maintain them, grow them, and sustain them once they start having kids. And we've actually designed Kids Out of Cities, and this is an attempt to try to design family friendly, child friendly cities once again.
Tell me why you think that that matters for cities. I mean, like, the core of the question is, why should cities be places that are safe and good for families with children and not just for, you know, professional adults?
Well,
why do you think that matters?
As mayors have told us across the country, it's an economic viability, that they need a tax base that will stay to put into the school system, to be close to the job so that they can attract and be employers of choice. You know, I was in Pittsburgh, and the mayor is talking about developing and attracting 25 new families to downtown area. Mayor Emanuel's trying to do the same thing in Chicago, just as Mayor Rawlings-Blake is trying to do. She's trying to attract 10,000 new families. And if you want to do that, you actually have to have amenities that have those strollers, that have these playgrounds and parks and walking paths, so that families can socialize and live together, not just live in their backyard, but live in the front yard and make the city the front yard. And we talk about, you know, playgrounds are important, but the whole city should be a playground, and play should happen everywhere. And there should be playful sidewalks, and bus stops may have swings on them like they've done in Montreal.
Talk about how you mentioned that you've been doing this work for almost 20 years now. Have the conversations changed over the course of time that you've been doing it? I was curious about how, when you first started this playability index idea, and just the basic project of Kaboom, which is building playgrounds and getting the community involved to build playgrounds, like, what kind of reception you had then versus what you have now?
Well, the reception is still the same, and people think that it's really nice what we do, and we're best in class at putting off a done-in-a-day volunteer experience. But we have to create a sense of urgency, and kids are losing their childhood, particularly the 16 million kids living in poverty, and that keeps me up at night, and that keeps our organization up at night. And we have to give them a childhood that they deserve, and play needs to be a part of that, and we need to work it back into where they live at home, their community around them at school, and caring adults that will participate in their lives. And the difference is that we have to create a sense of urgency around something that's so joyful.
How did this start for you? I mean, you've written a memoir about this, and you've written about this in the past. I don't know if you're kind of burned out on talking about it, but I would, if you don't mind, I would like to ask you, for people who don't know the story, about how you got started on this.
Yeah, well, I'm a product of charity myself. I grew up in a group home outside of Chicago and spent 14 years being raised by a charity. And I dropped out or flunked out of college and moved here to Washington, D.C. and was on a friend's couch and was building a playground project as more of a volunteer event when I read about two young kids in the shadows of the Capitol in Anacostia that had crawled into an abandoned car in 1995, suffocated, and died. And a reporter from the Washington Post went down to the neighborhood and couldn't find a park 3 miles from where they lived. And finger pointing was happening. The mayor was blaming Park and Rec, and Park and Rec blamed the housing authority. And I didn't set out to start an organization. I just said, I've got this skill to build a playground. Let's go try to remedy this situation for Aisha and Clinton. Because the difference was a community, when my situation happened to my family of 8, a community gave me a bear hug. And Aisha and Clinton's community didn't give them a bear hug. And I don't know what the circumstance of why it was different. I have some suggestions, some ideas, probably race, their zip code that they were born in versus where I was born. And those kids didn't get the childhood that they deserve. And so this has been my kind of fell into passion about trying to give the kids the childhood that I got, something equal and comparable.
Do you feel that there's a best practice place that you would point to? Is there some place that you feel in the United States or wherever that you would like other people to point to as an example of getting it right?
Well, in the Playful City USA program, we've recognized 212 cities, and they're on the right journey. They're setting bold goals. They're trying to solve big problems. They're trying to use play as a means to either addressing toxic stress or caring adults. And I look at what Chicago and the mayor is doing there. He's putting money up to build 300 new playgrounds within a seven-minute walk of every person living in Chicago. I look at Brownsville, Texas, the poorest city in the country, who's trying to use play as a way to preventing toxic stress that we know is a chemical condition that happens in your brain. And once it happens, it changes your ability to use the executive function, empathy, and resiliency. So I'm excited about some of the examples that we see, but it's just the start. And we need to both intensify the start that's happening, recognize what the best practices are, and then frankly have a dominoes effect to see more cities adopt family-friendly, child-friendly policies to see it scale.
Daryl Hammond is CEO and founder of Kaboom, and he was kind enough to join us in our studios in Washington, D.C. Daryl Hammond, thanks so much for joining us.
Michelle, thanks for having me.
Coming up, New York City's First Lady Shirlane McCray says it took a long time for her to get into taking care of her two children. Does that make her a bad mom, or was she just an honest one? Our parenting panel weighs in on the latest battle in the mommy wars that's just ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from John and Catherine Debs in support of NPR's new global headquarters and production center in Washington, D.C. From the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, helping people build measurably better lives, on the web at hewlett.org. From the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide at fordfoundation.org. And from Joyce V. Hale, in the interest of engaging an informed and civil electorate. This is NPR.
On the next Community Cinema, the documentary film The New Black takes viewers into the pews and onto the streets as it tells the story of the historic fight to win marriage equality in Maryland and charts the evolution of this divisive issue within the black community. I'm Sean Powers with Illinois Public Media News. Join me for the free public screening and panel discussion at the Spurlock Museum on Tuesday, June 3rd at 7 p.m. Free garage and street parking is available.
On the next Fresh Air, we discuss the growing Chinese presence in Africa, where Chinese firms are building infrastructure, extracting natural resources, and developing new markets. Journalist Howard French says, in the process, more than 1 million Chinese people have permanently settled in African countries. His new book is called China's Second Continent. Join us.
Weekdays at 11 a.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
WILL programming is made possible by Community Concierge Magazine. Every issue includes an event calendar, attractions, and maps, as well as a business and shopping guide. Community Concierge Magazine is distributed throughout East Central Illinois and always presents the CU area at its best.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. They say it takes a village to raise a child, but maybe you just need a few moms and dads in your corner. Every week, we check in with a diverse group of parents for their common sense and savvy advice. Today, we want to focus on the latest high-profile bout in the mommy wars. New York City's First Lady Shirlane McCray stepped into the fray with comments about her struggles when she first became a mother. Now, the comments came as part of a lengthy profile in New York Magazine, which was about a lot of topics, including how she and the mayor met, how they function as a political couple. But for some reason, the comments that grabbed headlines from the New York tabloids were these. McRae said, quote, "I was 40 years old. I had a life, especially with Kiara. Will we feel guilt forevermore? Of course, yes. But the truth is I could not spend every day with her. I didn't want to do that. I looked for all kinds of reasons not to do that," unquote. The New York Post put McRae's photo on its front page with the headline, "I was a bad mom." For that, the mayor, Bill de Blasio, demanded an apology, as well as run from the Daily News, which featured the headline, "Didn't want to be a mom." But other commentators have given that treatment a New York salute, saying she was just expressing what most people feel at some point. We wanted to talk about this whole thing, so we've called Bridget Schulte. She's a staff writer at the Washington Post and author of Overwhelmed, Work, Love, and Play, When No One Has the Time. She's a mom of two, and she wrote a blog post about this. Rocky Mercandani is a features editor for the New York Daily News and a mom of one who also wrote about the controversy. And Jamila Bay is a journalist, radio host, and mom of one. Welcome to everybody. Thank you all so much for joining us.
Thank you, Michelle.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks.
So, Bridget, you responded to this controversy in a recent column, a blog post for the Post blogs called, "Oh, the Bad Mother Police Have Been Out in Force Again." Who are the Bad Mother Police and why are they out in force again?
The Bad Mother Police are all of us. There is still so much ambivalence in our society about working mothers and the role of mothers and women in society. There is a lot of evidence, social science evidence, that shows what we expect of mothers is higher than it's ever been before. And we expect mothers to be completely self-sacrificing and will give up everything and anything to spend all of our time with our precious children. And the time studies show we actually do.
So do you think that, what did you think of McRae's comments overall?
I thought that she was absolutely on point, that there is an awful lot of difficulty. It's a very tough transition to go from being a single person with your own identity to all of a sudden being a mother and everything that that entails in our society. And the choices then that are laid out for you in a way that men do not face those same choices. Your horizons become an awful lot narrower. And when you go on into the article in the New York Magazine, she talks about what she ended up doing. She cut back her hours. She ended up driving to and from carpool. She ended up taking care of not just her kids, but both she and her husband's aging mothers. It certainly sounds like she's not just a good mother, but a pretty fantastic mother.
Rocky Mercandani, your paper, the New York Daily News, ran a smaller headline on its front page about McRae's comments that read, "Didn't want to be a mom," as I said. Now, Mayor de Blasio asked your paper and the New York Post to apologize for those headlines. You wrote a column saying that that was uncalled for, and I thought it was particularly interesting, and I'm glad you could be with us because you had just come back from maternity leave yourself. So how do you respond to this?
Actually, I wrote that column the day that I returned from maternity leave. So I spent the whole day, the whole week really, leading up to that, being worried about going back to work, what that was going to be like. I walked into the office. I did probably what most moms do. I cried on my way to work. People asked me how my daughter was. I cried then. I felt like the whole day I was crying. And after 2 days of being at work, I mean, I can't imagine not being back. So there's that piece of it. The apology part for me was really difficult because there was nothing to apologize for. We weren't judging her, especially she was judging herself. And I think that when you want to go ahead and do these New York Magazine interviews or other interviews, and then you also want to be able to control the way the press responds. You can't do that. You don't get to give the interview and then control the response.
You're saying like put your big girl pants on and just take it.
And if you want us to apologize, ask me yourself. Don't send your husband out there.
Okay, but of all the things that the paper wrote about that in that magazine article, why is it those were the pieces of that became the headline? I mean, didn't want to be a mom? Is that, I mean, the article itself is what, 10,000 words? It's about her political formation, how she sees politics. Tell me, I mean, I know that that's not your own piece, but why was that the headline? Why was that the only thing worthy of conversation?
She did say, I mean, you did quote it earlier, yeah, when she says, "Will we feel guilt about it forevermore," or something along those lines. I think that it's perfectly fair for the press, for us, for anyone to question that, to want to know more about that part of the story.
Jamila, what do you think?
Okay, see, the old Jamila would be incensed and would scream shame, shame at this point. But the Jamila that, you know, really wants to consider the larger issue here is this. This is a woman who for 20 had her own life, and all of a sudden In her arm, she held the future. She's looking at a culture that does not support mothers, particularly Black ones. She's looking at a culture where she knows her earning potential, her likely career trajectory is diminished, not always, but in her case, likely so, because of this human being who requires all of this support and all of this help. And she is the person who will be blamed for the failures and okayed for successes. Motherhood is hard. We have very little support from the government. And of all women, this one knows that. We really do our best. And I want to make sure that I am very clear when I say this. There is another issue to this. This is a Black woman having Black babies in America, and the urge for Black motherhood is not as great in this culture. We do not get rewarded the way that most moms get rewarded.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that's
so,
the word.
So tell me what you're responding to here. You feel that Shirley McRae was first being honest, and then
she
what
was
the criticism
being honest,
is what?
She's being honest, and the criticism does not take into account the very real fact that some women are helped more in motherhood and other women are just told, bear it, handle it, that was your decision, and how dare you not feel that a baby is a panacea to fixing your life.
Rocky, can you hit a little bit more on the politics? I mean, one of the things that you talked about in your column is the fact that when they needed the city to fall in love with their family, New York's first family trotted out their kids one follicle at a time, looking at the, for those who aren't familiar with the fact that both kids have pretty amazing hair.
Oh, yes.
And, you know, that has become kind of a thing. Is part of your argument here that if you're going to use your family for political purposes, you have to take it when it doesn't. It isn't as easy. Is that part of the issue here?
I mean, I think that, you know, they had Dante in ads. Kiara was out there. It was the afros, the flower crowns. And when it suited them and when they needed the city to be like, oh, my God, this is the family. I want to get behind you guys. I get it. They use the kids. She gives this New York Magazine interview. She talks about her kids. You don't get to pick and choose now the coverage that comes after. And if you're going to tell me that these are going to be the hallmarks of your administration, this kind of transparency, this openness. And then our coverage doesn't read like a Hallmark card the next day. You demand an apology.
But why? I guess I still want to ask the question, why is that your coverage? I mean, part of their argument of this piece is that the personal is political and that the struggles that people have as parents are shared and that other people, they use that to inform their politics, that people need more support for their families. I guess my question is, why is that the coverage? But her feelings about being a mom. I'm just curious about that.
I mean, I found that to be a really interesting piece of the story. There was lots of stuff in the story that I already knew, that a lot of us already knew. This was really interesting. This is the reason why we're talking about it today. I didn't really expect to hear that from her.
Go ahead, Bridget.
And it sparked a conversation, and that, I feel like, is perfectly fair.
Well, I think that absolutely having a conversation is really what we need to be doing. But I don't think about this particularly. Yes, they're a political family. She put herself out there. But out of a, you know, several thousand word article, that one paragraph, that is a fairly common feeling for pretty much any mother out there to then be labeled as a bad mom and to say that she didn't want to be a mom. I think that's taking it a step too far, frankly. You know, yes, have that, you know, maybe this is good that we're having this conversation, but it certainly felt like when you use breathless language, like this is an astonishing confession. Was she a quote unquote neglectful mother? You know, and this is a confession that would horrify most moms. Well, in fact, it really didn't.
If you're just joining us, we're having our weekly conversation about parenting. We're talking about the debate over New York City First Lady Shirlene McRae's comments about motherhood that came in a lengthy New York Magazine article. Our guests are journalist Bridget Schulte, Jamila Bay, and Rocky Merchandani. Rocky, do you want to talk a little bit more about that? Can I throw a theory out here?
Sure.
What is the theory that, I mean, this is a candidate that the New York tabloids did not support? I mean, is part of it that if this had been a candidate that the New York tabloids did support, do you think that there might have been a different reaction?
I mean,
I'm thinking about the coverage of somebody like Betty Ford, for example, when Betty Ford talked about her, the former first lady, talked about her struggles with alcoholism. You know, I wonder, very open about it, and then went on to have a very distinguished career as a treatment advocate for addictions. You know, that was celebrated and applauded.
But why is it so shocking that this was the piece of the story? I mean, had it been any other part, everyone would have been happy with the coverage and we wouldn't even be talking about it today. It was interesting. It was a shocking admission. We want to talk about it.
Bridget?
I don't see what's so shocking about it. And frankly, why wasn't there a question of, you know, where was Dad?
Jamila, what about it?
Good point. I love that question. I also want to point back to something that your other guest said a moment ago about, you know, trotting the kids out with their afros and everything. So if the, you know, again, I want to call attention to this racialized language here. If the kids had straight, curly, blonde locks, would that have been different? You know, these children have beautiful hair and they were not used as props. Everybody trots out their family when it comes time to run for an election. Nobody complained about Rick Santorum's brood when they came out and had picture on picture. If you were watching Pennsylvania coverage, when, you know, especially that last one he lost years ago. But it is the way that politics is done. And to try and call out this particular family and saying that the lamentation of a mother who's said what every other mother said, you know what, sometimes I didn't want to do that. You know, sometimes I wish I was my own identified individual, not somebody's mama. For, you know, to call that out and try and diminish her for that, to try and say that she's a bad mother or, you know, neglectful, that is yellow journalism. That is unnecessary. And frankly, it's really hurtful, especially to those of us who look like this woman and feel as she has before.
Just like you said, you were going to be like this was the new Jamila, and you were going to be all calm about it. I'm sorry.
Oh, that's right.
Go ahead, Rocky.
Just to be clear, no one is saying that anyone has to be just somebody's mother, and I was very clear about that in my piece. I don't want to just be my daughter's mother either. I am my own person. I am my own woman. I'm a managing editor at a major Metro daily. That's obvious. My issue was the apology. You cannot control the media's response. When you put yourself out there, you are not allowed to control the response to. You cannot control the story. And then you cannot demand an apology through your husband from the New York City tabloids.
Did you really find it shocking, Rocky? As a columnist, I feel like I can ask you this. Did you really find it shocking that she had a difficulty at times and did not find the unalloyed joy in being home with her kids all day long? You didn't find that? You found that shocking yourself, really?
I found
really,
pieces
honestly?
Of her statement shocking. Okay, I looked for all kinds of reasons not to do it. Mm-hmm. Trying to avoid her daughter. I found that shocking, absolutely.
Bridget?
You know, one of the things that really struck me the most in all of this coverage is when you look at who controls the media. You know, who's running the show, who's making the calls for what is a story, for what the headlines are. You know, the Women's Media Center recently put out a report, and it's pretty much the same. You know, it's not women. Women are not usually making these calls. And I think that this really shows, you know, I'm a mom. I've got two kids. I have certainly struggled with feelings of ambivalence and guilt and fear for their future. And I love them more than life itself. You know, so that motherhood is nuanced and it's complicated. And I think that if you had more I think all those studies will show if you have a critical mass of diversity, of people making decisions, you're going to get different decisions. You're going to get different coverage.
What about, though, but all of us have been working in major media for a long time. So let's just take Rocky's point seriously, which is that you don't get to then demand an apology. You can't have it both ways. You can't put your transparency out there and your honesty out there and then be mad when somebody takes it in a direction you don't like. What about it?
Well, you know, I suppose there is a point to that. You know, we're all in this sort of mix of journalism and everything's faster now and you say stuff and people get to think what they think about it and certainly tweet about it. That is, you know, there is a certain point to that. I guess my question goes even further back to who's making the decision about what is a story.
I am interested in how, Rocky, I don't want to put you on the spot here, but as you said, you put your politics out there, then you don't get to, you know, complain about how people take it. I will be interested if you've been in it a little longer. You just came back from maternity leave. I will be interested if, you know, how your babysitter feels, if you find her gossiping about you and saying, oh, you know, she just doesn't want to be home with her kid or something of that sort. But I'll just be curious if you're, you know, when you're in it a little longer, whether
right.
your perspective might be different.
I mean, of course, I've been a mom for 6 months. In the greater scheme of things, it's like 5 minutes. I get that. But I don't, you know, it doesn't really matter to me what whether the babysitter is gossiping, probably. But I don't want to be her full-time mom. I'm really clear about that. I'm sure most of my friends agree. They don't want to be someone's full-time mom.
So what is it that she said then you still find so shocking and worthy of the whole attention of this article?
I think I could not spend every day with her. Fine. I looked for all kinds of reasons not to do it. And then the other piece that says, will we feel guilt forevermore? About what? And then I the follow-up of, but I have lots of pictures of her, one-month birthday, two-month birthdays. It's like she almost caught herself mid. I was like, but I have lots of pictures, so the you know, I'm feeling guilty, but I have all these other, I have pictures of 1- and 2-month-old birthdays to, you know, I do love her.
We're going to check back. Bridget, how many years in have you got? How old is your oldest?
My son is 15, and my daughter is 13. And let me tell you, you know, am I soaked with guilt and remorse? I mean, wait till they get the report cards when you're like, oh no, was I not paying enough attention? Did I, you know, if I had only done something different.
Oh, and you forgot to get the eye exam.
You know, there are so many ways to fail your children, you know, with these standards that we have. It's really tough. It is tough to be, you know, all things to all people at all times, which is what we do expect mothers to be.
Jimmy, I'm going to give you the final thought.
We have to love our kids and we have to do the best. We are. It's a thankless job and there's not enough support and there's certainly not enough government support for us raising up the smallest and youngest citizens of this country. I think we need to stop attacking mothers and admit you've got the hardest job there is. Do your best and thank you.
Jamila Bay is a journalist and mom of one. She was here with us in our Washington, D.C. studios, along with Bridget Schulte, a staff writer at The Washington Post and author of Overwhelmed, Work, Love, and Play, When No One Has the Time, also a mom of two. Rocky Merchandani is a features editor for the New York Daily News and a mom of one. Happy Mother's Day, Mom, first one. She joined us from our bureau in New York and NPR in New York. Thank you all so much for joining us.
Thanks so much.
Bye.
And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and you've been listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.